Amazon will not have the power to stop their technology from being used for human rights violations if they so wish. Despite the humiliating conditions of this agreement, Google spokeswoman Shannon Newbury still gushingly boasted, "We are proud that Google Cloud has been selected by the Israeli government to provide public cloud services to help digitally transform the country." But almost 40,000 members of the public and 1,000 Google employees have signed a petition calling for the tech giant to pull out of the contract. And some workers are already resigning from their positions in protest. This full integration of the world's largest tech company with the Israeli military is only a matter of time. But the resistance still burns.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Huda Amori. As a founder of Palestine Action, Huda has led an unprecedented insurgency against Israel in the UK. She succeeded in shutting down two sites in England belonging to the Israeli weapons company Elbit Systems. And in coordination with the local community in Oldham, she helped to force Elbit Systems to sell a subsidiary in the town. And Huda joins us today via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What do you know about this Project Nimbus?
Well, this is a huge contract which which Google have signed with the Israeli government and which affects the military as well as other oppressive ministries and agencies in the Zionist entity. And it allows quite extraordinary capacities for the IDF, for Israeli intelligence agencies, for crowd control, for surveillance, for official recognition, for lie detection. Of course, these will be used straightforwardly in brutality and human rights abuses, and indeed, of course, in the torture which the IDF is well known for in the territories and indeed in 48 Israel itself. So this is a kind of an agreement which allows Google to help the abuses carried out day and daily by the state of Israel.
I mean, Huda, I assume you would agree with that, but tell me from your perspective, and what do you think this means for the Palestinian people?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that tech companies are now becoming more powerful than many governments. And when those tech companies work with the Israeli military, they're essentially aiding in all of the violations against human rights and the colonization of the Palestinian people. Now, practically, that means on the ground, encouraging the further blockade of the people of Gaza, the siege that has been routinely put on them, the blockade that has lasted over 15 years, and the constant military attacks, of which often Israel uses as an opportunity to test and improve the weapons that they use to then use against other people across the world. We know that Israel has already used cameras, surveillance cameras, as I've already mentioned, to blackmail Palestinians because they are so advanced in that arena. And this project is going to further add to that. But I think at the end of the day, when there are companies that many of us are forced into using, you know, it's often not a choice whether you use Google or Amazon because so many third-party platforms use them. It means that the weight and the size of the oppressors working against the Palestinians continues to increase. And as a result, we also have to increase our power, our grassroots power against them.
Mm. And Huda, can you tell us something about the apparent anti-BDS clause in the Project Nimbus contract?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at what BDS stands for, which is boycott, divestment and sanctions against the Israeli government to pressure them into complying with free demands, which include ending the colonization and occupation of Palestinian territories, including lifting the blockade of Gaza, for Palestinian refugees to have the right to return to their homes, which they were forced out of by Israel, and for Palestinian citizens to have equal rights as their Jewish counterparts. To have an anti-BDS clause is to go against those demands which are enshrined under international law and human rights conventions, and is to further perpetuate an apartheid system. But basically, by doing this, and by working with the Israeli military and government in the first place, Google and Amazon have basically called themselves advocates for apartheid and worse, against the Palestinian people.
David, what do you know about Ariel Curran, who resigned from Google over Project Nimbus?
Well, she was one of the people who objected to this activity, and there were quite a number. You saw 1,000 people there signed that letter. Quite a number of Jewish employees signed a separate letter complaining about the contract, and they've raised the issue of human rights abuses in all the ways that you would imagine. Of course, what happened was that these people were either sacked or were all resigned, and so there's been a huge clear out there of people who would have any kind of critical view on the contract. And of course, inside Google itself, there are a number of others who are very supportive of this contract, but partly for business reasons, one would guess, but also partly there are those in there who are ideologically supportive of the Israeli government, and that's a significant problem for Google as a corporation.
No, indeed. I mean, and Huda, what kind of treatment has Palestine Action received from tech companies?
Well, from the start of Palestine Action, it became very clear that not only were we fighting a battle against Elbit, but we also had to find new ways to actually be able to get our words and our message out there, which was against an Israeli arms company. Within a month or two, Facebook had removed us after we were rapidly growing to 20,000 followers within a month or two. That followed by PayPal, DonorBox, Open Collective, many more liberal platforms as well removed us. And in the end, I think it's about 10 different tech companies and third-party platforms have removed Palestine Action or outright told us that we cannot use their platforms. And we actually discovered, I think after the seventh platform removed us, that it was because Elbit's lawyers were writing to them directly and that they were scared of a lawsuit and they were scared of going bankrupt. So basically, Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms firm, were blackmailing, using legal warfare to blackmail companies into removing any support for our movement. But it has consistently failed to do so. And actually, the fact that they are forced into spending so much money on these lawyers to do so, I think is a testament to the success of Palestine Action.
Mm. You know, David, the tech aspect of Israel's activities doesn't really get the attention it deserves, does it? I mean, how can that be combated?
Well, these are difficult stories to explain to people, I think. I mean, people understand human rights abuses. They understand direct support for human rights abuses from Zionist organisations and their activities in this country, in the US, for example. But trying to understand the technicalities of tech, if you like, of Google, of Amazon, of Twitter, is difficult for people. And also, they don't see the inside of these companies. So the fact that there are huge numbers of people who are from Israeli intelligence organizations inside the social media companies, people don't get that, they don't understand that, they don't know about that. So I think partly the question is how you explain this story to people, how you explain the strategy which is being used by the State of Israel to penetrate tech companies so that they will be supportive of the human rights abuses conducted by the State of Israel. So that's the key question, it seems to me, is to how you explain to people how tech is a useful and interesting way to look at the abuses caused by the State of Israel.
Yeah, and say a little bit about this Unit 8200, which you know people will have heard about, I'm sure, but may not be totally familiar with what it is. Can you just give a little bit of background briefly?
Unit 8200 is an Israeli intelligence organisation, so people will be familiar with Mossad, which is like the equivalent of the CIA or MI6 in the UK. But Unit 8200 is like the GCHQ, is the signals intelligence, this is the surveillance intelligence organization. It's part of military intelligence, it's part of the IDF, and they are engaged in the huge amount of surveillance there is of Palestinians. What we've been talking about just now, the attempt to surveil Palestinians, to spy on them, to gather compromise on them, to gather information about which can be used to blackmail them, to stop them joining the resistance or to make them informers. There's a huge amount of activity there, and these people are leaving this organisation and going into something like Google or Twitter. And that's really quite scary.
No, indeed. I mean, interesting, of course. Sir Keir Starmer appointed a former Unit H200 operative to head up the Labour Party's social media activities. But we'll just have to pause there for a moment to have this report on how Israel lobby groups and former Zionist intelligence operatives are active in relation to Google.
Google's integration with the Israel military has been a steady development in which several key Israeli lobby groups have played an active role. Firstly, a group of employees within Google, which calls itself the Juglers, has been accused of driving right-wing ideologies and actively surveilling Arab and Muslim employees. The group successfully forced Google management to apologize for a donation it gave to the Movement for Black Lives Coalition on the basis that groups within the coalition had stated their solidarity with Palestinians. Another key entanglement Google has had with Israeli intelligence came with the founding of a tech hub by the name Team8. The CEO and co-founder is Nadav Zafrir, former commander of the infamous Signals Intelligence Unit 8200 in the Israeli military. Team8 was co-founded with Eric Schmidt, who at the time was executive chairman of Google.
Believe it or not, in all the years that I've worked with Israeli companies, this is my first physical visit here.
Really?
And I now understand why everybody was so excited about the country. Yeah. You know, it really is startup nation.
Yeah, it is.
And for the stuff that I do, it's like the perfect positive storm.
Yeah.
You know, the sum of the educational system, the way the military works.
It's the curse into the blessing.
Well, no, but it's you may not appreciate how significant an advantage it gives you because you're used to it, right? You live it, but it's notably different from any other country, and you really feel it.
Israel lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League, is a select contributing member of YouTube's Trusted Flagger program, meaning that Google allows it to regulate content on the most used video service in the world. In a declassified FBI memo from 1969, it is questioned if the ADL, quote, represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act due to the, quote, extreme close ties between the ADL and Israel. Google is also a member of the ADL Silicon Valley Anti-Cyber Hate Working Group. Another part of this integration has been the Startup Nation central organization set up by Republican donor Pauli Singer. The stated purpose of the organization is to combat BDS by feeding big tech jobs into Israel, but also by feeding Israeli workers into big tech companies. It's through organizations like Startup Nation Central that you have huge mass of former Israeli intelligence agents working inside Google today. A Mint Press investigation found there are at least 99 former Israeli Intelligence Unit 8200 personnel currently working inside Google, many of them working in very sensitive positions in the company. No doubt the Juglers lobby group will include them amongst their number. Some include Gavriel Gordel, who from 2010 to 2016 worked in Unit 8200, analyzing intelligence data to understand patterns of hostile activists. Today, he's the head of strategy and operations at Google. Jonathan Cohen was a team leader at Unit 8200 and is today the head of insights, data, and measurement at Google. The list is long and dangerous. Today, Google stands as a technological weapon against Palestinian liberation.
David, what do you make of the tactics of this Juglers group within Google then?
Well, it seems to be a kind of unofficial Zionist lobby group, doesn't it? And of course, as a speculation in the film there, presumably many of the people who are in or who were in Unit 8200, the Israeli intelligence organization, are part of the Juglers group. And they've been, you know, they attacked and have been involved in the surveillance of Muslim employees of Google. But also, the key thing was the return of this donation to Black Lives Matter Foundation, which is a truly extraordinary thing. It's part of this whole idea that is promoted by the ADL, who we saw in the film there, and indeed by similar lobby groups in the UK, like the Community Security Trust. The idea that it's only racism against the Jews which is important, that's the most important form of racism in the society, and we must not engage with groups like BLM in case they have, for example, supporters of Palestine amongst their supporters, which of course they do. So it's an attempt really to focus all attention of liberals on anti-Semitism as the preeminent form of racism in society, and to make sure we don't talk about anti-black racism and certainly not about anti-Palestinian racism.
I mean, Huda, organisations like Team8 and Stand Up Nation Central, seem to be combating BDS by feeding figures from the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit H200, into big tech companies. So, yet these outfits are relatively anonymous to most people. I mean, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's almost slightly similar to Elbit, in the sense that these companies don't necessarily want the attention, and they shouldn't want the attention, because they are aware that if people were completely exposed to it, it would be widely condemned and it wouldn't be allowed to happen in the first place. And so often you find that these companies stray away from public attention and operate more in the shadows, because by placing Unit 8200 officers into companies like Google, it's essentially infiltrating spaces which harvest a lot of data. You know, these are power hubs for data collection, of which there have been many scandals in the past. But now it means that our data, my data, or anyone else's data who works for the Palestinian people, is exposed to people who have and may continue to work on behalf of the Israeli government in order to perpetuate its oppression against the Palestinian people. And obviously, this is not something which you would know when you use Google, because it's so widely known, or Amazon. And that's what makes it a dangerous and effective strategy that the Israeli military or these companies are trying to use in order to gain access to that data without people's knowledge.
David, the Anti-Defamation League, I mean, tell us a little bit about its history and why is its relationship with YouTube a cause for concern?
Well, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has been in existence for over a century now, and it started up as a branch of the B'nai B'rith, one of the key international Zionist organisations. And from very, very early on, in fact, from the 1940s, from before the creation of the State of Israel, it's been engaged in spying on Arab Americans and attempting to work with the FBI to harass them and to convict them for crimes. So it's been doing this since the 1940s, and indeed in the 80s and 90s, there were court cases against it where it was revealed that it had been spying on thousands and thousands of activists, left-wing and liberal activists, including anti-apartheid activists in the case of South Africa, and it was actually selling data that it had collected from its spying operations directly to the apartheid regime in South Africa. So this is an organisation which is effectively an implement, an instrument against the left, which poses as being an anti-racist organisation. Mm. And it's very similar in a way to the Community Security Trust in the UK, which does similar stuff here, spies on the left. Indeed. Now, it's worrying because they also, because they pose as liberals, they have access to, you said YouTube, but also to the Twitter safety panel and to many other social media companies' safety panels. So, and this is the case not just with the ADL in the US, but with the CST in the UK, with Le Crif in France. The Zionist organisations are able to moderate and help to moderate content on social media companies in a way that no Muslim organisation, and certainly no Palestinian organisation, is able to do. So there's a fundamental imbalance here. Even if we leave out of account the former intelligence operatives who work inside the companies, we have Zionist organisations helping them to take decisions.
Mm. I mean, Huda, organisations like Team 8 and Startup Nation Central seem to be combating BDS by feeding figures from the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit 8200, into big tech companies. Yet these outfits are relatively anonymous to most people. I mean, why do you think that is?
It's disgusting, and I think the timescale says a lot, that this happened, their promotion happened after the Project Nimbus had started. He became head of strategy in October 2022. And I mean, I think in general, the fact that anyone had a job for harvesting data on hostile activists is a bit of a strange term to use in the first place. But it shows that, and I think Ariel, a former Google worker, has said this, that in the past few years, it's become clear from inside Google that there is an institutional Zionist bias. And I don't think it's a coincidence that many of these former Unit 8200 officers have been entering Google in those few years at the same time. So I think we're seeing a steady increase in the fact that Google is going to be used as another tool for the Zionist project. And In all, Israel has created an economy based on the domination of the Palestinian people. And I think what we're seeing here in general is these companies are trying to cash in on that colonization and oppression of the Palestinian people. And as long as we allow that to continue, we're going to see more and more powerful big tech companies, which normal people across the world are using day to day, also cashing in on that oppression.
David, I mean, what would you say the significance of this chap, Eric Schmidt's relationship is with Israel?
Well, I mean, you saw a little bit of the clip there with him with Benjamin Netanyahu from some years ago. And if you've watched the whole clip, it's really quite vomit-inducing, this obsequiousness. And I mean, saying to Netanyahu, I'm not sure you realise, Benjamin, just how fantastic your country is. And specifically mentioning the military, you know, nobody in the world who's ever had any attention to the media would be unaware of the horrific war crimes committed by the IDF day and daily, and the ongoing abuses that we see on television news every night. Even on the mainstream news, we see these things, never mind on alternative sources. So that's a significant issue. Now, I mean, was this the question of what he said there, but also, of course, as shown in the film, the involvement in various startup firms, which amongst which are those which help to bring people from the high tech into the high tech industry from the Israeli military, the Israeli government, and indeed even from Israeli companies. So that attempt to bring people together from Israel into the West and vice versa is an attempt, you know, in the end to increase the support for Zionism.
Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. So that's it for today's show. I hope you found the programme informative again. Thanks to our guests, Huda Amori, and our resident expert, of course, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. is last on a ranking of healthcare systems among 11 of the wealthiest countries in the world. Meanwhile, a new study reveals that this country ranks last among peer nations for COVID-19 mortality. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The United States ranks dismally among its peer nations when it comes to deaths from COVID-19. Dismal might not be a strong enough adjective, actually. The U.S. ranked dead last among its peer nations with the most deaths per capita. The data comes from a new study published in a medical journal, JAMA, which also analyzed the state-by-state vaccination and public health data. Alarmingly, researchers noted that if every state in the United States had the same vaccination rates as those states with the highest vaccination rates, more than 100,000 lives would have been saved. Led by researchers from the Brown University School of Public Health and the University of Pennsylvania, Perelman School of Medicine, The JAMA study compared data on vaccinations and COVID-19 mortality in 2021 and 2022 between the United States and 20 other most populous countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. Not surprisingly, the per capita death rate was higher in America than any of those other 20 countries during the Delta and Omicron waves in 2021 and 2022, with America accumulating 370,298 COVID-19 fatalities in total. Yet the data was particularly illuminating when the authors compared the 10 U.S. states with the highest vaccination rates with those that had the lowest vaccination rates. According to JAMA's study, the per capita rate of COVID-19 death in the 10 states with the highest vaccination rates, 73%, was 75 deaths out of every 100,000 people. By contrast, the 10 states with the lowest rates of vaccination, 52%, had a per capita death rate of 146 out of 100,000 people. But on an international scale, the numbers looked bad too. The 10 most vaccinated states had an excess all-cause mortality rate that was equal to or less than that of several other OECD countries, including Denmark, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Austria, and Finland. The phrase all-cause mortality rate refers to the total death rate based on all causes of death within a total population for a given period of time. That number is meaningful because many deaths that were on paper from other causes were indirectly caused by COVID-19. The authors of the study conclude from June 27, 2021 to March 26, 2022, the U.S. would have averted 122,304 deaths if COVID-19 mortality matched that of the 10 most vaccinated states and 266,700 deaths if U.S. excess all-cause mortality rate matched that of the 10 most vaccinated states. If the U.S. matched the rates of other peer countries, averted deaths would have been substantially higher in most cases, including range 154,622, 357,899 for COVID-19 mortality, 209,924, 465,747 for all-cause mortality. This means that if the 10 states which had the fewest number of vaccinated citizens had been inoculated at the rates of 10 states with the highest percentage of vaccinated citizens, roughly 122,000 people who died of COVID-19 during the 9-month period covered by the study would have lived instead. Similarly, if throughout the United States the total amount of excess deaths from all causes had been the same as in the 10 most highly vaccinated states, more than 266,000 deaths would have been avoided. The United States Dismal Public Health Ratings owe a debt to the haze of vaccine misinformation that pervades the United States and which has become dogma among some right-wing politicians who have encouraged the spread of public health misinformation for political gain. Although anti-vaccine conspiracy theories became increasingly popular due to the COVID-19 pandemic, they long preceded it. In 1998, soon-to-be discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield published a case series which claimed that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, MMR vaccine, was linked to the development of autistic traits in young people. A panic ensued until it became clear that Wakefield's paper was riddled with problems. It had no data about MMR vaccine, included speculative conclusions, only reviewed a small sample of patients, and used a poorly designed experimental model. It later came out that Wakefield also had financial conflicts of interest, which he had not disclosed when publishing the study. Anti-vaccine ideas became more prevalent in 2020s after the COVID-19 pandemic reached the United States. Popular podcaster Joe Rogan touted supposed COVID-19 treatments that didn't work, such as horse dewormer in vermistin. Rogan's ideas spread thanks to other anti-vaccine celebrities. There is no scientific evidence indicating that purported COVID-19 treatments like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, vitamin C and vitamin D are effective in stopping COVID-19 infections, while monoclonal antibodies can be effective, and Paxlovid works well. Both are second-line defenses that are much more likely to be given to the unvaccinated when they contract the virus, as unvaccinated persons typically have far worse outcomes if and when they contract COVID-19. According to Guardian, the U.S. is last on a ranking of healthcare systems among 11 of the wealthiest countries in the world, despite spending the highest percentage of its GDP on healthcare, according to a new report from the Commonwealth Fund. The country struggles with deep problems in affordability of healthcare, which affects access and equity, and it is the country that has the most administrative hurdles when dealing with the healthcare issue. This is despite the U.S. spending 17% of its gross domestic product on healthcare, far above the other 10 countries, according to the report. The other countries analyzed in the report were Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and the UK. The ranking is based on 71 measures across 5 areas: access to care, care process, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. The report notes that unlike the other countries in the study, the U.S. does not provide universal healthcare coverage. Americans are more likely to have problems paying medical bills and have their insurance denied. A larger percentage of Americans say they spend a lot of time on paperwork for medical bills, and doctors report having more trouble prescribing medication for patients because of restrictive health insurance coverage. The report notes that unlike the other countries in this study, the U.S. does not provide universal healthcare coverage. Americans are more likely to have problems paying medical bills and have their insurance denied. Americans also deal with lackluster access to care, with more American adults going to the emergency room for non-emergency care. Doctors of top-performing countries are usually readily available by phone or on night and weekend. The U.S. also has the largest disparity in care among income groups. We have almost 2 healthcare systems in America, one for people with means and insurance, and another one that falls short for people who are uninsured or don't have adequate insurance coverage. Eric Schindler, the lead author of the report and senior vice president for policy and research at the Commonwealth Fund, told Washington Post. Health statistics reflect the reality of having the worst healthcare system on the list. The U.S. has the highest infant, maternal, and avoidable mortality rates. The country also has less support for early childhood education and support systems, like unemployment protection for workers, leading to poorer health outcomes.
discovering Islam. The story of Tawheed is not limited to the creation of the world or oneness of God. Another important aspect of Tawheed is that we have to worship the one and only God. But why should we worship God? What is the purpose of worship? Why should we worship a God who does not benefit from our worshiping? And why is worshiping anything beside or in association with God the greatest sin according to the Quran? Man is a worshipping being and cannot be free from worship in one form or another. If we do not worship God, we worship other things, even including our ideas, our aspirations, or our desires. The moment we cease to worship, our life is disrupted.
The word in Arabic for worship is Aliha, which is used in the phrase La ilaha illallah. The word Aliha actually means a number of things. It means to worship. It also means to be obsessed with. It also means to rely on someone in time of need. It also means to be in love with someone. It also means, as, continuing the idea of obsession, to not be able to think of anyone else. To feel or to miss someone intensely when they're not present. And so when we say La ilaha illallah, we are saying there's no one worthy of worship, or of love, of obsession, of reliance. No one worthy of me turning to them in time of desperation and need other than Allah.
Tawheed in worship is one of the most important aspects of Tawheed. For it's not a matter of belief anymore, but a matter of action as well. It shows how committed one is in their faith. It is the manifestation of the soul and heart of a believer in their practice.
Worship in action includes that your intention, you have to have ikhlas, which means pure sincerity for the sake of God. Not your ego, not to please others, not to please society, but to please the one that created you.
Worship is to adore, to praise, and to humble oneself towards the object of worship. The Quran states that some people take their fleeting desires as the objects of their worship.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Afara'aita man ittakhadha ilahahu hawa. Have you seen the one who takes his own base desire as his Lord? So associating partners to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not only worshipping an idol. The individual might worship his own lower self. When I'm worshipping, when I'm obeying other than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that can be my nafs. That itself is a form of shirk. As we know, we have two different types of shirk. The first type is shirk al-khafi. Shirk al-khafi is the hidden shirk. And the second type is shirk al-jali. It is the apparent one. The apparent one is the person in the temple worshipping, if he's truly worshipping the idol. But the khafi one, the hidden one, the minor shirk, is me taking my lower desire, taking the power, taking the position, taking my wealth as my Lord. And both of these types of shirk takes me to destruction, because it's taking me away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All human beings are bound to worship something. It is in our nature to worship. The only thing is, are we picking the right authority, or the Quranic word is ilah, or God, to worship? Quran actually details a few false gods. For example, Hawa, the god of desire. So if we were to become ibad, or servants of desire, what would happen to us? We would be destroyed. We would have self-destruction. We would not be able to live our lives in the best way possible. So it is indeed our nature to worship something and our best interest to worship Allah.
You have people who are free of the worship of God, who free themselves of the worship of the Creator. However, that's not to say that it's not replaced by the worship of something else. So you see people who don't worship God end up worshiping earthly pleasures, they end up worshiping money or power, they end up having addictions which become like a kind of worship because there is such a strong dependence on them. So man can free himself of worship of God's, man can free himself of God's worship simply because he has the free will to do so. However, that's not to say that it's a choice without consequence.
In our day-to-day experience, we can see how sometimes we are humbled to and infatuated by our desires. This is because realizing those desires is very important to man. And thus, he is prepared to humble himself before anything that may help him to bring about what he wants and to realize his desires. And this is probably how idol worshiping came about.
Idol worship is an aberration of the heart and mind. Idol worship is essentially the ego, because I think all idol worship stems from self-worship. Because there's going to be an element where you're going to be worshipping your ego, because your ego is that veil that prevents you from seeing the truth.
People used to worship idols because they thought they controlled the sources of what they sought. If they wanted a child or money or victory or good harvest, there was a god for each of them who could fulfill their need. It was sheer material need which made them to turn to God. And since God was so transcendent, they sought more immediate deities to talk to.
Many people find it very difficult to understand a transcendental God, a God that is everywhere, but at the same time so far away from us, a God who's all-powerful, but we're so impotent, a God who is living everywhere but we will die, a God who is powerful to do anything yet we can struggle to do anything. When there is that very big gap between where we are and where God is, there feels that there needs to be some sort of intermediary to get there. And that is where this idea of idol worship happens. And the idea that they can worship someone who acts as a mechanism to get to the purest God.
The big question is, why has God placed this sense of worship in man? Why are we instructed to worship him? Is he in need of us worshiping him?
Well, I would never want to worship a God that actually benefits from me. That would mean God is not God anymore. It means he's weak, he's needy. God's name is the free. Al-Ghani, he's free, he's independent, he's self-subsisting. That deserves to be worshipped.
Fundamental to the conception of God in Islam and in the Quran is that he is independent. He is needless. Huwa al-ghani. The verse continues, wa antumul fuqaraha. You are the needy. You are the dependent. So God does not need our worship whatsoever.
Wa ma khalaqtu al-jinna wal-insa illa liya'budun. How should we interpret this verse in the Quran, which states that God has not created jinn and human being, but to worship him?
Some people misunderstand this ayah and think God just wants us to just be praying to him all the time and do nothing else, just pray, because we have no other purpose in life. Actually, all the other things, like, it's the same God who said, وَجَعَلْنَا لَكُمْ فِيهَا مَعَايِشَ. He put on the earth things for you to live well. He wants you to live well in this world. He wants you to dress well, eat well, sleep well, have a nice family, enjoy yourselves. He wants those things for you. And guess what? When you do them, you are actually fulfilling a command of Allah by utilizing the things he made for you.
People sometimes make objections as to why, if God does exist, he needs to be worshipped. Surely if God exists, he is free of any such need. Why do we have such a needy God who needs to be constantly told that he's right, that needs to be constantly told that he's great? However, really the truth is that, of course, God doesn't need to be worshipped at all. And we don't worship God because it is in any way adding to his being or taking away from it if we are not worshipping him. We worship God because we need to worship God, because we need to have a sense of grounding and a sense of direction. We worship God as a reminder of who put us on this earth, as a reminder of why we are here, and as a reminder of where we will ultimately end up. If we didn't remind ourselves of God and of his existence every single day, we would very soon forget. And then where would we be? Where would we be? We would be completely lost.
Thus, the only meaning that we can imagine for this verse is that worship brings us closer to him. And by him, we mean the absolute perfection.
If I want to get closer to perfection, or if I want to become perfect myself, I need to take this perfection or these attributes from the source of perfection.
Worshipping God has nothing to do with him requiring it. God is considered to be Ghani. He is needless of any of our worship. But at the same time, it is us who need that worship. We need this opportunity to really excel in this life. Why? Because that will help us in the hereafter, and it will help other people in this world. And that's the core essence of why we are here. We need to have this opportunity to excel.
So what is the purpose in this worship? The purpose in this worship is nothing more than for humankind's benefit, to help humankind move towards those pinnacles of existence and to take on those godlike qualities in their life.
The famous verse which states that God only created man and jinn to worship him clearly states that the aim of the creation is the journey towards God. And let's be reminded that God is the source of all perfection. Hence, the conclusion is this life is about worshipping him, i.e. is about taking this journey towards perfection.
There remains another essential question here. How should we worship God? Are rituals enough as worship?
Ritual performance is nothing if it isn't a means towards godliness and goodliness. And we see this throughout the Quran. Worship in its truest sense is servitude towards God, to become as God would like one to be. This isn't done through the performance of any ritual. Rituals are purely instrumental.
Worship means obedience. Worship means submission to the will of God. Worship does not mean that you should constantly sit in the direction of Mecca and continue to pray and pray and pray. As long as you are living your life according to the will of God and you're not disobeying, every single breath that you're taking is worship.
Too often we talk about worship solely in terms of ritual. We talk about worship solely in terms of doing things. Whereas worship in itself is the remembrance of God as God should be remembered. It is the remembrance of God in a way that reminds us of his greatness. And if what we are doing, whatever ritual we are performing, is not reminding us of the greatness of God, then really it is not an act of worship, it is mere ritual.
In other words, anything we do in this world in remembrance, love, and obedience of God can be regarded as an act of worship.
To summarize it is to love God, to obey him, and to worship him. And that translates in many things. Praying 5 times a day, doing dhikr, which is the remembrance of God, actually being in service to your fellow human beings is also a form of worship if you're doing it for the sake of God. And that's worship in action in a way, when you're doing actions like serving others and giving acts of charity. Because we believe that acts of worship, but the only true worship if you do it for the sake of God.
Worship is an evolving process. And when one worships with an understanding of what God is, one always has to work towards perfection.
So our ritual fasts and prayers are not the only acts of worship. Our love for our family and relatives, any help extended to fellow human beings, to win bread for our dependents, could as well be regarded as acts of worship.
A vicarious remembrance. Look at the signs. Look at what is around you. And you will get the feeling that he is with you even though you don't see him. And the final step, which is excellence, al-ihsan, is to worship him as if you are seeing him. But how? Out of love. In kuntum tuhibbun Allah. Worshipping is to love, is not only to abide by the rules. You abide by the rules because you love. And you show your love because you abide by the rules. So it's a virtuous cycle, and this is the meaning of worshipping.
Apart from the acts we offer as worship, worship has an essence. Its essence is based on placing one's hope and fear in God alone.
Tawheed in worship means that the type of humility, obedience, fear and hope offered to God should not be offered to anyone and anything else. This is the path to man's perfection because it emancipates human heart and soul from all other types of worship.
Idol worshipping is considered a great sin, and the reason for this is because the very feeling instilled in man to bring him closer to God is diverted to leave him further away from God.
When you have a relationship with the one who is all perfect, because that's who he is, and he is the most beautiful, and he's the most perfect, and he's the most loving, then you want to emulate those qualities in your life. You want life around you to be more and more beautiful. You want more and more love in your life. You want more and more, you know, better and better things in your life. Because at the end of the day, this quest will come to a conclusion when you finally meet him and you actually get to see perfection itself.
But should we fear God or love him? Are fear and love compatible with each other? The Quran actually advises us that at the same time that we love God, we have to fear him as well. And different experiences of fear are mentioned in the Quran, or different levels of fear. Taqwa, khashya, shafaqa, rahba are but some examples.
The relationship between fear and love is one which is seen as a dynamic in Islam, okay, and often portrayed as such. They can be two sides of the same coin, okay, and fear and love are not wholly incompatible. Absolutely not are they wholly incompatible. Having said that, the predominant ethos of the Quran is one of love, okay, as is encapsulated in that repeated reference to God as being Rahman and being Rahim, the unqualified giver.
Every relationship comes with love and fear. Why is it so hard to understand with God? We have to love him and we have to be afraid that he might be upset about something. But if your relationship in this world, if your relationship is only love and you're never afraid, like if I think about my wife, yeah, I love her, but I'm never afraid of disappointing her. I'm never worried about saying something that might hurt her feelings. I might think the relationship is perfect, but she might actually think that I don't care about her anymore. If my relationship with her is only about fear, oh my God, she's going to get angry. If I say something, she's going to get so mad, right? Then over time, I will lose all love for her. All that's left is fear.
We have to start with loving him.
once we base our understanding on rationality, then you cannot but love him. Fear, of course, there are consequences to our decisions. These consequences can be consequences between us and God, or things that affect people around us. Punishments is part of the equation, is part of the existence. You take the wrong decision. The Quran states is that not that God has ascribed certain punishments to this wrong decision. Your wrong decision itself, in reality, has these negative consequences.
Taqwa is the beginning of all those different levels of fear, and it is the beginning of worship. It is faith put to application. It is fear of losing God's support and trying to win His favor. But our fear of God is not purely for the consequences. It is sometimes an awesome experience of His greatness.
Khashya is a fear as a result of knowledge and leads to action. It is when you know the greatness and the magnitude of what you fear, and as a result, you have reverence of it. There is another type of fear mentioned in the Holy Quran, which is referred to as rahb. Rahb is the kind of a fear that makes you very alert, very careful, and does not let you relax. It is like the type of fear that the students have during exam time. They're careful, they're restless, and they're concerned about their passing. It is also fear that you're afraid that you'll disappoint the one you love. The final type of fear which is mentioned is shafaqa. Shafaqa is the fear that some harm will come to a person you love. It is that type of fear. It is a fear that is mixed with love, such as the love of a mother for her children. She is fearful out of love for them.
If worshipping God is so important for the perfection of man, what happens if it is directed to concepts, objects, or persons other than God?
It's a divergence from the straight path. Does it have consequences? It does. Because we are meant to direct our thoughts and our actions with the unlimited being that is God. Once we attach ourselves to a limited form of existence, i.e. any form of an idol, because he's limited, our journey towards perfection will be very limited and very short, and it will hinder our progress towards perfection. So to free ourselves and to go back on the straight path to that endless journey towards the absolute perfection, we need to be free from idol worshipping and direct this energy and this fellowship to God and God only.
Well, when you worship your own desires, for example, avid materialistic culture, avid individualism, you have social breakdown and decay. If you look at the Children's Society report that was published in 2009, it came to the conclusion that our societies are breaking down because of what? Avid, excessive individualism. What's in it for me? I'm all right, Jack. And that, in a way, is worshipping the ego, is worshipping a false god. So it does have negative consequences in society, definitely.
Associating partners with God is an utter misjudgment. Now, that's because Allah is the reality, and what He invokes besides Him is nullity. Chapter 22, verse 62, He is the only source of good, perfection, or existence. This implies those who evoke others besides Him are under an illusion.
But fear is only one leg of worship. The other very important component of worship is hope. Hope to go closer to God and to be included in His favor and mercy. Hope to be good enough to be loved by God and to be granted His love in our hearts. It's only through these two components of fear and hope that the true worship is realized. And that is something that should be offered only to God and no one but God.